Welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic is WebSphere MQ version 7 Client Enhancement. Today's presenter is Lurani Wheeler. Lurani has worked for IBM for over 30 years as a developer, MVS system programmer, and customer support representative. He worked in TCP/IP customer support for 10 years before joining the WebSphere MQ support team. In this role, she focuses on solving WebSphere MQ issues on COS and VSC platforms, as well as service integration bugs and WebSphere MQ file transfer edition issues on COS. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Lurani.
Thank you, Joseph. This presentation is WebSphere MQ version 7 client enhancement. Could you go to the next page, page number 2? The presentation will cover the new client enhancements introduced in MQ version 7.0 and MQ version 7.0.1. Next slide, slide number 3. In version 7, we'll talk about conversation sharing, client connection limiting, connection groups, message properties, and some of the new MQ APIs. Next slide, slide number 4. In version 7.0.1, we'll talk about multiple instance queue managers, automatic client reconnect, enhanced SSL security, and enhanced .NET support. Next slide, slide number 5. We'll also talk about some ZOS enhancements, log compression, group units of recovery, generic application structure backup, and admin structure recovery. Slide number 6. The first thing we're going to talk about is conversation sharing. And this requirement came about because customers wanted a way for multiple JMS sessions to share one socket. So multiple instances of an MQI channel can be made to share a single TCP/IP connection. If a channel is defined with ShareConv parameters set to greater than 1, then that number of conversations can share a channel instance. Next slide, slide number 7. This is a pictorial view of conversation sharing. You can have multiple MQCons going out over one socket, and we have a receive thread that's sitting there just waiting for information for each one of these conversations. So with conversation sharing on the client, now we can do heartbeat at any time. In version 6, you can only do heartbeat during an MQI call because there was no thread sitting there waiting for the information to come back. With conversation sharing, there's a thread sitting there all the time waiting for the information to come back. So heartbeat packets can flow back and forth at any time on conversation sharing. Next slide, slide number 8. So the new ServerCon channel parameter called ShareConv, if it's set to 0, all sharing is off, and the channel basically operates in the MQ version 6 mode, and you don't have any access to any of the version 7 APIs. If it's set to 1, then sharing is still set off, but the channel now can operate in the MQ version 7 mode, which means that you have access to the new version 7 API. If it's greater than 1, then the channel starts sharing up to the negotiated value, and that value is negotiated down. So if you're trying to talk to a version 6 queue manager, then you won't, no sharing will occur, and the default is 10. And if the channel is set to conversation sharing, if you don't want your application to share, then at MQ Connect time, you can set your connection operation, connection, the no conversation sharing, and it'll be equivalent to ShareConv 1. Now let's go to slide number 9. Okay, so we're going to talk about limiting client connections. And this feature came about because customers wanted a way to limit the number of ServerCon channels that can start from a particular client. Sometimes you have a misbehaving client application that comes in and ties up all of the channels, and now you hit a max channel situation. So there's two new parameters on the ServerCon channel called maxint and maxintc. Maxint restricts the number of instances for a particular ServerCon channel, and maxintc restricts the number of instances of a ServerCon channel that can be started from a particular IP address. And you don't have to specify that IP address under the covers. We keep a count of how many connections have come in for that particular IP address. Next slide, slide number 10. So this is a pictorial view of limiting client connections. Client number one has started two Servicon channels, and when he tries to start a third Servicon channel, he's going to hit max NC, which is set to 2, and he's going to get channel not available situation. So we have another client coming in that's connecting, starting this Servicon, the same Servicon channel, and either this client could have started another Servicon channel and we would have been at max int, or we have another client coming in that starts another instance of that Servicon channel. So we have four instances of this Servicon channel started, and if the fifth client tries to start another instance of this Servicon channel, then he's going to get channel not available. Next slide, slide number 11. Okay, connection groups. Now, connection groups are not new in MQ. The connection group is used so that your channel, your client channel definition table can define a group of queue managers that the client can connect to. But in version 6, those channel definitions were chose basically in an alphabetical order. And once you chose a channel definition, you basically use that channel definition to connect to the queue manager each time. In version 7, there are two parameters that influence the selection of those channels. You have client weight, which specifies a weighting factor to influence the channel connection, the channel client definition that's selected. And then you have affinity, and basically affinity has preferred or none. And preferred says that you're going to work like you did in version 6. If you chose a channel to connect to a queue manager, you basically use that channel each time. If you specify none, then we'll randomly select that client channel that you use to connect to. Next slide, slide number 12. So this is a pictorial view of group connections. We have a weighting factor of 4 for channel 1 and channel 2, and a weighting factor of 2 for channel 3. And so we'll see that the channel connections are pretty evenly distributed for channel 1 and channel 2, and then channel 3 is going to only have 40% of his channel selected. Okay, next slide, slide number 13. Now we're going to talk about message properties. And those who use JMS, message properties are not new to them, but the message properties are part of an MQRSH2 header that's part of the message payload. So the application that's receiving this message must be aware that this RFH2 header is in the message. So with MQ version 7 applications, now you can add properties to a message. And a property is a name piece of data that's not treated as part of the message payload. And you access these properties by means of a message handle in the MQ PMO or the MQ GMO. Next slide, slide number 14. So a version 7 application can choose how they want these properties returned to the application. If you have a GMO properties and handle, then the properties are going to be returned by in a message handle. Properties force in MQRFH2, you're going to return these properties in an RFH2 header. If you have GMO no properties, then you're going to remove all those properties before the message is given to the application. If you specified GMO properties compatibility, then if you have any version 6 JMS properties, then those properties are going to be returned as normal in an RFH2 header. And if you don't have any of these coded, then the new prop control queue attribute will determine how these properties will be returned to the application, and the compatibility mode is the default. Next slide, slide number 15. So these are some of the new APIs that are used to manipulate message properties. You have a method of creating a message handle, so you can access the message properties. You can delete a message handle. You can set or modify the value of the message property. You can inquire on a message property, delete a message property. And you can also take properties that's in an RFH2 header and convert them to properties that you can access by a message handle. And you can also do a reverse operation. You can take messages that are in a message handle and convert them into RFH2 headers. Next slide, slide number 16. Added advantage of using message properties is now you can use message selectors as an extra criteria for selecting specific messages. Prior to MQ version 7, if you were coding MQ native calls, then you could only select by the message ID or the call ID. And the JMS implementation of selectors, you had to actually browse all the messages and then select the ones that fit your criteria. Applications now in version 7 can use a message selector to only receive those messages that meet a specific criteria based on either what's in the message header or the message property. Next slide, slide number 17. So we have some new message property samples that you can use to play around with. So AMQSSTM gives you an example of how to put a single message with a user-specific property. You also have one to show you how to get a message property and display that property. And then we have samples of how you would, we have add a third parameter to show you how to choose how those properties are returned to the application, and also a sample API exit working with those properties. Next slide, slide number 18. So we're going to talk about now some of the new MQ APIs that were introduced in MQ version 7, asynchronous consumption of messages, asynchronous put response, and read ahead of messages. Next slide, slide number 19. So asynchronous consumption of message is somewhat based on the way JMS would do things. When you receive a message in JMS, you could call an on-message routine that would actually handle the message once you received it. So now asynchronous consumers can allow the application to register an interest in a message and then identify a callback routine which can be invoked when a message arrives. So this allows the application not to be tied up sitting waiting on an MQ get call. And when the application is notified of a message, then that information is passed back to the application in a message buffer, so the application doesn't have to try to guess on the size of that buffer. And this application can basically register an interest in any number of queues. Next slide, slide number 20. So your MQCB defines your message consumer, and then you have an MQ cuddle call, which controls whether message consumption is currently operable. And once you call your MQ cuddle call and specify an HCON, then you basically give up the control of that HCON so that the callback routine can use that HCON. And if you try to use that HCON for any other call other than an MQ cuddle call, such as you want to stop consuming, you want to pause consuming, you want to resume consuming, then you're going to get a return code that basically say that HCON is already active. So you're going to get HCON async active return if you try to use that HCON other than on an MQ cuddle call. Next slide, slide number 21. For the MQCB ties a function which you describe in your MQ callback descriptor to an object handle. And you can define two types of callback functions. You can define a message consumer which is tied to the object handle, and you receive messages or you get errors back on the queue, such as a queue full situation. You can also register an event handle which is tied to the connection handle, and it'll receive no error notification about the connection, such as the queue manager is quiescing. Next slide, slide number 22. So we're going to talk about now asynchronous put response. So anybody who's coded the client application knows that a lot of the time is tied up sending a MQ put request to the server, and then the server has to respond back with the MQ put reply. So you get an MQ put request, go to the server comes back, the MQ put reply, and that's back and forth through the network. Where the asynchronous put will allow the application to send messages to the server, but you don't have to wait for the server to come back with an MQ put reply. And then once the application has completed its sequences of MQ puts, then it can issue an MQ commit or MQ diff, which will flush out any other MQ puts that are remaining. And since you don't wait for the server to send back a response, you can issue an MQ stat call, and this MQ stat call will in turn give you back how many messages were successfully put and how many failed. And this call can be issued at any time, but if you issue an MQ put and then issue an MQ stat call, then it's basically you kind of defeated the purpose. Next slide, slide number 23. Again, read ahead of messages. It's basically the same type of situation. Your application will issue an MQ get request and wait for the server to come back with an MQ get reply. With read ahead, a client, it allows non-persistent messages to be sent back to the client without the application having to request these messages. So a server will send as many non-persistent messages matching the criteria such as message ID as can be sent based on the limit that's set up by the client application. And I think that limit was max size, which can identify the size of the receive buffer. So if an application requests read-ahead messages, but there are no suitable messages, such as the messages are persistent, then read-ahead is actually effectively turned off, and those messages will flow one at a time as they did in the past. And read-ahead is then turned back on when you get a sequence of non-persistent messages on the queue again. Okay, for every queue that's going to participate with this read-ahead, you're going to get a read-ahead buffer, okay? That's an in-memory buffer. So if the application ends with messages in this buffer or the machine crashes, then these messages will be lost. Slide number 24, please. So if you want to gracefully close an application that's doing read-ahead, there's a new MQ close option called MQ CO Quiesce. And once you do your MQ close with this option specified, if there are still messages in that read-ahead buffer, then you're going to get back an MQ read-ahead messages to let you know there are still messages there. And you can continue to issue your MQ get, and once you issue your MQ get and you get to the end of that message buffer, then you're going to get a return code saying that there are no more, basically you're going to get return code H object quiesce no messages, which is equivalent to no messages available. So you want to be careful because the default for MQ close is MQ close immediate, which will throw away any unconsumed messages if the application crashes, if the application goes away or the machine crashes. Next slide, slide number 25. So now we're going to talk about some of the enhancement in version 7.0.1. Next slide, slide number 26. So some of those enhancements, again, multiple instant queue managers, automatic client reconnect, enhanced SSL security, enhanced .NET support, log compression, group units of recovery, generic application structure backup, and admin structure recovery. Next slide, slide number 27. Okay, so multiple instance queue manager. This is just multiple instance queue manager provides a basic failover support without an HA coordinator. If you need to access other resources, then you'll still want to use your HA coordinator. The queue manager data is held in network storage, so MQ ensures that only one instance of the queue manager is active at one time. So you can start multiple instances of a queue manager on different machines, but they must be on the same platform because the queue manager data is shared. So you'll have one active instance, and then you're going to have one standby instance. The active instance owns the queue manager file, and the active instance will accept connections from the application. The standby instance does not own the queue manager file. The standby instance is sitting there just polling and waiting to get the lock on this network system file. And if the active queue manager goes down, then the standby queue manager can get those locks, come up, and perform its restart and become an active instance of the queue manager. So you're only limited to an active instance and a one standby instance. You can have other queue managers ready and available to become a standby instance, but at one time you're going to have only one active and one standby instance. So next slide, slide number 28. Again, it's not like an HA coordinator, which will reroute our IP addresses. So the IP addresses are not taken over. So you're going to have to define your channels and your clients to know where your queue managers are. So you have in your client name, you have to have your host name and port number for every queue manager that's going to participate in this multiple instance queue manager scenario. The network storage, the queue manager storage is on network storage, and so every version of the network storage are not supported. NFS 4 is supported, but version 3 is not supported. And you also have some of the Windows network and storage systems that are supported. But to ensure that the queue managers will work in a multiple instance queue manager environment, we do ship a tool to validate your configuration. And then there are new options on the Create MQM, Start MQM, and the End MQM to control the operations of how these queue managers come up and created and ended to enable us to do the failover situation. Next slide, slide number 29. So here's what you would do to set up for a multi-instance queue manager. So you need to create the queue manager data and logs on the network storage, and we send you a tool called AMQMFS Check to check out the directories that you're going to use to put your data. Then we're going to do another check to make sure that the POSIX file locking behavior is what we expect. And then we're going to ask you to run a test on two machines to ensure that the locks are handed off correctly. And then we're going to also ask you to run another check to see if to attempt concurrent writes, to make sure that we're only going to overwrite anything or corrupt any files. All three of these tests must run successfully on both machines. Otherwise, your environment is not set up for multi-instance queue manager support. Okay, next slide, slide number 30. So here are the commands you're going to use to create your queue manager. So you're going to do your create in QM, which your MD is going to point to your data storage, and your LG is going to point to your log storage, and then you're going to define your queue manager. And so that's going to happen on machine A, which is going to be your active queue manager. Then you're going to define on machine B, which is going to be a standby queue manager. You're going to do an add MQinfo, which is going to really copy the information that you're going to use on machine A to machine B. Then on machine A, you're going to do a start with the minus X parameter to start that queue manager, which will become the active queue manager. And then, because he's coming up first, and he's getting the lock on the network file system. And then we're going to start the standby instance of the queue manager on machine B. And then if a queue manager on machine A goes down, then the standby on machine B would take over and become the active instance of the queue manager. Slide number 31, please. So we have a display command that's going to show you the status of each, the active and the standby queue manager. So on machine A, display MQ minus X minus O standby, it's going to tell you that this queue manager standby is permitted, so it's in a multi-instance queue manager environment. The status is running, and you're going to say that the active queue manager is on machine A, and your standby queue manager is on machine B. If you issue the same command on machine B, you're going to also see that standby is permittable, and it's going to tell you that this queue manager is running as a standby, and where your active queue manager is also running. And as I said, you can have multiple queue managers configured. So if you have a QM1 configured on another machine and you do this display command, you're going to see that, yes, he's permitted to become a standby queue manager, but his status is that the standby instance of a queue manager is running somewhere else, and it's going to identify where this queue manager is active and standby instance. Next slide, slide number 32, please. So if you want to completely stop a multi-instance queue manager, then you issue the NMQM with the minus I immediate, which stands for immediate on machine A, and that will end both instances. If you want to just end the standby instance of the queue manager, then you go to that machine and do NMQM minus X. If you want to switch over, to the standby queue manager on machine A, you would end NQM with immediate and S for standby, and the standby queue manager will become active. Next slide, slide number 33. Okay, so now we're going to talk about automatic client reconnect. When the application gets like a 2009 connection broken, if you do manual reconnect, then the application is required to recreate the connection to the queue manager by doing the MQCon or CONX, and then reopen all of the objects after the failure. With automatic reconnect, the connection is automatically restored, and the handles to those objects that were open are automatically restored after a failure. So we're trying to hide the fact that a queue manager failed by restoring the object to its current state. So say, for example, if your MQ put called and it returned with a 2009, then we're not going to pass the 2009 up to the application. We're going to basically, under the covers, issue another NQ con, NQ open, and an NQ put. And continue on, and the application should never see that it reconnected. It may see, you may think that the connection may be hung if you're having a little time trying to reconnect, but you won't see a bad return call go up to the application to reconnect if successful. Next slide number 34. So again, if you want to specify the queue managers that's going to be used with reconnection, if you want to reconnect to a different queue manager, you have to specify it in your con name, and you can also specify it in the environmental variable, in your NQ server environmental variable. And there's a total reconnect timeout, which is configurable, and that timeout, the default is 30 minutes. So there's a reconnect delay also, which says I'm going to try to reconnect at this delay interval up to 30 minutes. Or whatever you have configured there. The default is 30 minutes, but you can reconfigure the reconnect timeout, and you can also reconfigure delay interval that we use to try to reconnect the client. Next slide number 35. So the requirements for using the automatic client reconnect is the server and client must both be at NQ version 7.0.1, must be a threaded application, because we have a thread sitting there, you know, just handling the reconnect scenario, and then you have to have ShareCon B greater than zero. Otherwise, if you fail any of these tests, then you're going to get an environmental error. Return back to the application. Next slide number 36. So in your NQCon call, you can, in your connection options, you can do NQ connection option reconnect, or NQ connection option reconnect queue manager, which means that you want to always reconnect to the same queue manager, or you can do NQCon reconnect disabled, meaning you don't want to, your application to try to reconnect at all. And some of the options that are not supported with automatic reconnect is NQ PMO logical order and NQ GMO logical order, because we can't guarantee the logical order of the messages after the reconnect. Next slide number 37. So in your NQ client.ini, you can also put your default recon parameter here. And this is what will happen unless the application overrides it in that NQ con call. But if you have disabled specified, then you can't override it with the NQ con call. Your application just cannot do any reconnect if you have disabled defined in this parameter. Next slide number 38. So you should no longer see the connection broken to 2009, but we'll see reconnect fails if we've had the reconnect timeout and you still can't get you connected, then you're going to see a reconnect fail. If you ask to be reconnected to the same queue manager and for some reason that queue manager is not up, then you're going to get a reconnect QMID mismatch, and also you're going to get reconnect QMID required if we try to reconnect and we've issued some type of call that requires us to be connected to the same queue manager. Next slide number 39. So the reconnectable scenarios are you'll be reconnected if there's a communication failure, if the queue manager or the listener fails, and if you do a stop cons command, which is going to basically kill the socket, then you're going to be reconnected. And if you issue the NQM-S switch or the NQM-R, which kind of means reconnect, then you'll get your client's reconnect. The following will not cause a reconnect: a stop channel, unless you have to force that channel, which is basically going to kill the socket and cause an error. So you will get reconnected if you have to force the channel down, but not with just a normal stop channel. And any other NMQM call will not cause a client reconnect. Next slide number 40. So now we're going to talk about some of the SSL enhancements introduced in 7.0.1. So SSL and TLS can provide authentication, confidentiality, integrity, and non-repudiation. It also provides a way to check to see if your certificates have been revoked. Next slide number 41. So that's not new in NQ, because we already have an LDAP server that we can use to check to see if a certificate has been revoked. But now we have a new alternative method of checking to see if the certificates have been revoked, and that's called OCSP. And OCSP stands for Online Certificate Status Protocol, and it's defined by RFC 2560. And OCSP is a request response protocol, which is you basically send a request to see the status of the certificate, and it will come back with a response so that you know the status of the certificate. OCSP requests and responses are sent over an HTTP protocol, and that is the only protocol that is supported in MQ. Next slide, slide number 42. So you can specify the location of your OCSP responder basically in the same way that you do with your LDAP server in the MQL structure of the client MQCon call, in the CCDT table for a client, using the AutoInfo object in the QManager SSL CRL name list, and also embedded in the AutoInfo access certificate extension. Next slide, slide number 43. You can have both of LDAP and OCSP configured on the same system, but the sequence of checking whether the certificate has been revoked is based on the underlying SSL socket library. So if you're using GSKit for Windows or Unix, then we're going to first go to the OCSP responder, which has been explicitly configured. If we don't find one there, then we're going to go to the OCSP responder as found in the Auto Information Access Certificate Extension. Next, we'll try the LDAP server that has been explicitly configured, and then we're going to try the LDAP server found in the CRL Distribution Port Certificate Extension. Next slide, slide number 44. So, unfortunately, OCSP right now is not supported on i5OS, ZOS, or in the Java and ZMS client. With the newer JREs, there is an ability to set up the OCSP responder URL security property, but that property is not set for MQ Java or JMS code. Next slide, slide number 45. Okay, so let's talk about another SSL enhancement, secret key reset. And secret key reset is not new either. Secret key reset is used to after a number of bytes have flown over an SSL connection, then the secret key is renegotiated so an attacker can't figure out your secret key. Both client and server libraries must support a compatible version of this secret key reset protocol. Next slide, slide number 46. Java socket support secure layer version 2 changed the way that SSL secret key resets are done. So in able to allow the MQ Java JMS clients to perform SSL secret key resets with the QManager using the GSKit, we provided an alternative version of the GSKit known as GSKit 7.5. Now GSKit 7.0 is still the default GSKit that will be used, but you can also dynamically load the GSKit 7.0 or the newest GSKit 7.5 SSL library. Next slide, slide number 47. So you can download GSKit 7.5 by going to Fix Central at this link here. Then you can add alter GSKit equals yes to your SSL standard or the QManager. Then issue refresh security type SSL and restart your SSL channel, and you'll now be accessing the new GSKit 7.5. And there are details provided in the README file for GSKit 7.5 on the IBM Fix Central website. Next slide, slide number 48. Okay, so let's talk about an enhanced .NET support called WCF. WCF is the Microsoft Windows Communications Foundation, and it's a set of new APIs that was introduced in .NET 3.0 that provides communication and service framework. Its primary focus is for SOA, or the service-oriented architecture. WCF is going to simplify the integration by separating the roles of the transporting and encoding data. So WMQ is going to be used as one of the transport channels. And it's just a pictorial view of where MQ is going to fit at the transport channel. Next slide, slide number 49. This is a picture of how MQ Customs Channel is integrated here. It's integrated on top of the message service client for .NET, and so we're going to be using the XMS.NET API. And you have three different connections to the queue manager. You're going to have a managed client connection, and basically everything is going to be managed in the XMS code. You're not going to have any services such as SSL support or XA transactions. You're going to have the unmanaged server connection, which is basically like a binding connection. Everything's going to be located on the same system. And then you're going to have the unmanaged client connection, which is a client connection coming in to your queue manager. Next slide, slide number 50. So now let's talk about some of the VOS enhancement that was introduced in MQ version 7.0.1. We came up with a new log compression. We had customers that were running into DASTI constraints and log data bandwidth constraints, and they were trying to do this in SEP, so they requested that we put this in the product. So it may not be for everybody, but for those who are running into these type of constraints, then the log compression will help. And we're going to use the run length encoding method to compress this data. And we're going to compress those records that are inserted into the log record for private queues only. We won't be compressing records for shared queue records. And you can use the SMF 115 record to show what type of compression rates you're achieving. And log compression is achieved through the VPARM. You can specify comp log none, that means you don't want the compression turned on, or you can have compressed log, comp log RLE, and that's the only method that we have right now, RLE. There is a comp log any, but right now that defaults to RLE. And you can display these parameters with the display log or set these parameters with the set log, and the queue manager does not have to be restarted. It can be dynamically done. And CSQ1 log P will print these records out, either compressed or uncompressed. Next slide, slide number 51. Okay, another ZOS function here is group level units of recovery. So transaction, the client now can be configured to connect to a queue sharing group on ZOS rather than a single queue manager. This allows recovery of in-out messages that can be performed on any queue manager in a queue sharing group, so you don't have to depend on one particular queue manager being up to recover these transactional units of recovery. So right now it's required to be in an XA transaction client. For example, you may have an XA client in WAS, then you configure your WAS client to connect to the queue sharing group name rather than the queue manager group. And you can also pass in this group, the queue sharing group name in on the XA info stream when you do your XA open call. And in order for a queue manager to participate in this group level units of recovery, then you have to enable that queue manager with a group UR queue manager attribute. Next slide, slide number 52. Admin structure recovery. Queue managers that are prior to version 7.0.1 can only rebuild their own admin structure entry when the queue manager is coming back up. And this created an issue for customers who were trying to do disaster recovery because you had to have every queue manager up before you could recover all of the admin structures. In MQ version 7.0.1, the first queue manager that starts can rebuild all the admin structures for all the members of the queue sharing group. So you no longer have to have a queue manager up to recover all of the admin structures. Next slide, slide number 53. Another feature for shared queue, you can now back up CF structures if you specify. You could always back up CF structures, but now if you specify an asterisk, you can back up all of the recoverable CF structures, and you can also now add a wildcard that would allow you to back up CF structures. So if you do a backup CF structure, CSQ asterisk, then that means you will back up all of the recoverable structures that began with a CSQ that's followed by zero or more characters. Next slide, slide number 54. So that's the end of my presentation, and this chart includes links to a number of sites that provide valuable online resources for WebSphere products. And I'm going to turn it back over to Joseph.
Thank you, Lorraine, for a great presentation. At this point, Amy, we would like to open the lines for questions.
Our first question comes from Jack Kane. Line is open.
On your foil number 9 for your ServerCon connections, you had made reference to the new parameter max inked C.
Right.
And that MQ would be keeping track of the volume that was there. Is there any way of displaying that volume?
Displaying how many connections from a particular client?
Correct.
Not at this time.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Mathu Algapan. Your line is open.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to ask a few questions. First one is like, we have listed a lot of features in MQ client that works without MQ 7 version installed, like connecting MQ 7 client to an MQ 6 server. Do we get all these API calls and all privileges we have seen so far?
No, you have to be talking to a version 7.0.1 client, well, 7.0 client to get message consumer, read ahead, and put response. And then client reconnect, you have to be talking to a 7.0.1 queue manager.
Okay, but for the maximum client connections and sharing conversations, that was connecting version 7.0 client to a 6.0 queue manager?
No, it's only version 7. You have to talk to a version 7 queue manager.
Okay. So nothing works if you talk to a version 6 queue manager?
Correct.
Okay. And one more question is like regarding the asynchronous consumption of messages and the consecutive topic, the asynchronous put response. So I'm not much differentiating the current working with this feature. Like in the current put or in the current scenario, we can do an asynchronous put response, like where you can put a message and you need not wait for the response, right? Similar way you can do for the consumption of messages. You need not consume the messages in order. You can consume in any particular order. So what does these features differ from that one?
Well, in put right now, if you would look at it, you would see that a request goes to the server, and basically, well, most clients do wait for the response to come back to see if that put was successful. Here now, you don't have to wait for that put call. You just issue put, and then at a point you can issue an MQ stat to see how many puts were successful and how many failed.
Okay. And regarding the consumption of messages, asynchronous consumption of messages?
Right. What is the question for consumption of messages? What's the question?
Uh-huh.
So, I'm sorry, I missed that question for consumption of messages. What was the particular question?
No, I just wanted to know on the asynchronous consumption of messages as well.
Well, asynchronous consumption of messages will allow you to issue a GET and then have a particular callback routine execute once that message comes back. You don't have to sit there and wait on the MQ GET. Once the message gets back, then if someone like a JMS on message, when you get a message on the queue, then you execute a piece of code to handle that particular message.
Okay. So you mean to say it's like kind of a publish-subscribe pattern?
I'm not sure if I would equate it to public-subscribe. I would basically equate it to a JMS on message. If when you get a particular message on the queue, then you have a piece of code that would execute and handle that message.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
At this time, there are no other questions.
Thank you, Amy. At this time, we will conclude the presentation.